A letter can sometimes be safer than speaking, because there is time for you to read what you have written before sending it. As you read your words, you can visualize the other person receiving your letter and decide if what you have written is skillful and appropriate. Your letter has to water the seeds of transformation in the other person and stir something in his heart if it is to be called right speech. If any phrase can be misunderstood or upsetting, rewrite it. Right mindfulness tells you whether you are expressing the truth in the most skillful way. Once you have mailed your letter, you cannot get it back. So read it over carefully several times before sending it. Such a letter will benefit both of you. Of course you have suffered, but the other person has suffered also. That is why writing is a very good practice. Writing is a practice of looking deeply. You send the letter only when you are sure that you have looked deeply. You don't need to blame anymore. You need to show that you have a deeper understanding. It is true that the other person suffers, and that alone is worth your compassion. When you begin to understand the suffering of the other person, compassion will arise in you, and the language you use will have the power of healing. Compassion is the only energy that can help us connect with another person. The person who has no compassion in him can never be happy. When you practice looking at the person to whom you are going to write a letter, if you can begin to see his suffering, compassion will be born. The moment compassion is born in you, you feel better already, even before you finish the letter. After sending the letter, you feel even better, because you know the other person will also feel better after reading your letter. Everyone needs understanding and acceptance. And now you have understanding to offer. By writing a letter like this, you restore communication. Writing a book or an article can be done in the same way. Writing is a deep practice. Even before we begin writing, during whatever we are doing, gardening or sweeping the floor, our book or essay is being written deep in our consciousness. To write a book, we must write with our whole life, not just during the moments we are sitting at our desk. When writing a book or an article, we know that our words will affect many other people. We do not have the right just to express our own suffering if it brings suffering to others. Many books, poems, and songs take away our faith in life. Young people today curl up in bed with their Walkmen and listen to unwholesome music, songs that water seeds of great sadness and agitation in them. When we practice right view and right thinking, we will put all of our tapes and CDs that water only seeds of anguish into a box and not listen to them anymore. Filmmakers, musicians, and writers need to practice right speech to help our society move again in the direction of peace, joy, and faith in the future. Telephone meditation is another practice that can help us cultivate right speech. Words can travel thousands of miles. May my words create mutual understanding and love. May they be as beautiful as gems, as lovely as flowers. You may like to write this gatha on a piece of paper and tape it near your telephone. Then, every time you are about to make a phone call, place your hand on the phone and recite these words. This gatha expresses the determination to practice right speech. Even as you say the words, your mind already becomes more peaceful and your insight more clear. The person you are calling will hear the freshness in your voice, and your words will bring her great happiness and not cause suffering. As our meditation practice deepens, we are much less caught in words. Capable of practicing silence, we are free as a bird, in touch with the essence of things. The founder of one of the schools of Vietnamese Zen Buddhism wrote, "Don't ask me anything else. My essence is wordless." To practice mindfulness of speech, sometimes we have to practice silence. Then we can look deeply to see what our views are and what internal knots give rise to our thinking. Silence is a time for looking deeply. There are times when silence is truth, and that is called thundering silence. Confucius said, "The heavens do not say anything." That also means the heavens tell us so much, but we don't know how to listen to them. If we listen out of the silence of our mind, every bird's song and every whistling of the pine trees in the wind will speak to us. In the Sukhavati Sutra, it is said that every time the wind blows through the jeweled trees, a miracle is produced. If we listen carefully to that sound, we will hear the Buddha teaching the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness helps us slow down and listen to each word from the birds, the trees, and our own mind and speech. Whether we say something kind or respond too hastily, we hear what we are saying. Words and thoughts can kill. We cannot support acts of killing in our thinking or in our speech. If you have a job in which telling the truth is impossible, you may have to change jobs. If you have a job that allows you to speak the truth, please be grateful. To practice social justice and non-exploitation, we have to use right speech. Chapter 13. Right Action. Right action, samyak karmanta, means right action of the body. It is the practice of touching love and preventing harm, the practice of nonviolence toward ourselves and others. The basis of right action is to do everything in mindfulness. Right action is closely linked with four, the first, second, third, and fifth of the five mindfulness trainings. The fourth mindfulness training is about right speech. The first training is about reverence for life. Aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. We may be killing every day by the way we eat, drink, and use the land, air, and water. We think that we don't kill, but we do. Mindfulness of action helps us be aware so we can stop the killing and begin saving and helping. The second mindfulness training is about generosity. Aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I am committed to cultivating loving kindness and learning ways to work for the well-being of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I will practice generosity by sharing my time, energy, and material resources with those who are in real need. I am determined not to steal and not to possess anything that should belong to others. I will respect the property of others, but I will prevent others from profiting from human suffering or the suffering of other species on earth. This training tells us not just to refrain from taking what is not ours or exploiting others. It also exhorts us to live in a way that brings about justice and well-being in society. We have to learn how to live simply so that we do not take more than our share. When we do something to promote social justice, that is right action. The third mindfulness training is about sexual responsibility. Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I am committed to cultivating responsibility and learning ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without love and a long-term commitment. To preserve the happiness of myself and others, I am determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. Loneliness cannot be alleviated just by the coming together of two bodies unless there is also good communication, understanding, and loving kindness. Right mindfulness helps us protect ourselves and others, including children, from further suffering. sexual misbehavior creates so much suffering. To protect the integrity of families and individuals, we do our best to behave responsibly and encourage others to do the same. Practicing this training, we not only protect ourselves and those dear to us, but we protect the whole human species, including children. When right mindfulness shines its light on our daily life, we are able to keep this training steadily. Sexual misbehavior has broken so many families. There has been so much suffering because people do not practice sexual responsibility. A child who is sexually abused will suffer his or her whole life. Those who have been sexually abused have the capacity to become bodhisattvas, helping many children. Your mind of love can transform your own grief and pain, and you can share your insight with others. This is right action, and it frees you and those around you. When you practice to help others around you, at the same time, you are helping yourself. The fifth mindfulness training encourages mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. This is linked to the Four Noble Truths and all of the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, but especially right action. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I am committed to cultivating good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society, by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. I will ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy in my body, in my consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of my family and society. I am determined not to use alcohol or any other intoxicant, or to ingest foods or other items that contain toxins, such as certain TV programs, magazines, books, films, and conversations. I am aware that to damage my body or my consciousness with these poisons is to betray my ancestors, my parents, my society, and future generations. I will work to transform violence, fear, anger, and confusion in myself and in society by practicing a diet for myself and for society. I understand that a proper diet is crucial for self-transformation and for the transformation of society. Right action means bringing into our body and mind only the kinds of food that are safe and healthy. We practice mindful eating, mindful drinking, not eating things that create toxins in our body, not using alcohol or drugs for ourselves, our family, and our society. We consume mindfully so that life will be possible for all of us. We practice mindful consumption to protect our body and our consciousness from ingesting toxins. Certain television programs, books, magazines, and conversations can bring into our consciousness violence, fear, and despair. We have to practice mindful consumption to protect our body and consciousness and the collective body and consciousness of our family and our society. When we practice not drinking alcohol, we protect ourselves, and we also protect our family and our society. A woman in London told me, "I have been drinking 2 glasses of wine every week for the last 20 years, and it has done me no harm at all. Why should I give it up?" I said, "It's true that 2 glasses of wine do not harm you, but are you sure they do not harm your children? You may not have the seed of alcoholism in you, but who knows whether the seed of alcoholism is in your children? If you give up wine, you'll be doing it not only for yourself, but also for your children and for your society." She understood, and the next morning she formally received the 5 mindfulness trainings. That is the work of a bodhisattva, doing it not for herself alone, but for everyone. The Ministry of Health in France advises people not to drink too much. They advertise on television, 1 glass is okay, but 3 glasses invite destruction. They want you to be moderate in drinking. But if the first glass were not there, how could there be a 3rd glass? Not having the 1st glass of wine is the highest form of protection. If you refrain from having a 1st glass, you are protecting not only yourself, but all of us at the same time. When we consume mindfully, we protect our body, our consciousness, and the body and consciousness of our family and society. Without the fifth training, how can we transform the difficult situation of our society? The more we consume, the more we suffer, and the more we make our society suffer. Mindful consumption seems to be the only way out of this current situation, the only way to stop the course of destruction for our body, our consciousness, and the collective body and consciousness of our society. Looking deeply, we can see the interbeing nature of the five mindfulness trainings and the Eightfold Path. We apply right mindfulness to see whether our eating, drinking, and consuming is right action. Right view, right thinking, and right speech are all present when we put the fifth mindfulness training into practice. The five mindfulness trainings are interpenetrated by the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, especially right action. Right action is based on right view, right thinking, and right speech, and is very much linked to right livelihood. Those who earn their living by manufacturing weapons, depriving others of their chance to live, destroying the environment, exploiting nature and people, or producing items that bring us toxins may earn a lot of money, but they are practicing wrong livelihood. We have to be mindful to protect ourselves from their wrong action. If we don't have right view and right thought, and are not practicing right speech and right livelihood, even if we feel we are trying to go in the direction of peace and enlightenment, our effort may be wrong action. A good teacher only needs to observe a student walking or inviting the bell to sound to know how long he has been in the practice. You look at his right action and see all the things that are contained in it. Looking this way into any of the elements of the path, you can measure the realization of that person as far as the whole path is concerned. There are so many things we can do to practice right action. We can protect life, practice generosity, behave responsibly, and consume mindfully. The basis of right action is right mindfulness. Chapter 14. Right Diligence. Right diligence, samyak pradana, or right effort, is the kind of energy that helps us realize the Noble Eightfold Path. If we are diligent for possessions, sex, or food, that is wrong diligence. If we work round the clock for profit or fame, or to run away from our suffering, that is wrong diligence also. From outside, it may appear that we are diligent, but it is not right diligence. The same can be true of our meditation practice. We may appear diligent in our practice, but if it takes us farther from reality or from those we love, it is wrong diligence. When we practice sitting and walking meditation in ways that cause our body and mind to suffer, our effort is not right diligence and is not based on right view. Our practice should be intelligent, based on right understanding of the teaching. It is not because we practice hard that we can say that we are practicing right diligence. There was a monk in Tang Dynasty China who was practicing sitting meditation very hard, day and night. He thought he was practicing harder than anyone else, and he was very proud of this. He sat like a rock day and night, but his suffering was not transformed. One day, a teacher, Master Hurang, 667 to 744, asked him, "Why are you sitting so hard?" And the monk replied, "To become a Buddha." The teacher picked up a tile and began polishing it, and the monk asked, "Teacher, what are you doing?" His master replied, "I am making a mirror." The monk asked, "How can you make a tile into a mirror?" And his teacher replied, "How can you become a Buddha by sitting?" The four practices usually associated with right diligence are 1. Preventing unwholesome seeds in our store consciousness that have not yet arisen from arising. 2. Helping the unwholesome seeds that have already arisen to return to our store consciousness. 3. Finding ways to water the wholesome seeds in our store consciousness that have not yet arisen and asking our friends to do the same. And 4. Nourishing the wholesome seeds that have already arisen so that they will stay present in our mind consciousness and grow stronger. This is called the fourfold right diligence. Unwholesome means not conducive to liberation or the path. In our store consciousness, there are many seeds that are not beneficial for our transformation, and if those seeds are watered, they will grow stronger. When greed, hatred, ignorance, and wrong views arise, if we embrace them with right mindfulness, sooner or later, they will lose their strength and return to our store consciousness. When wholesome seeds have not yet arisen, we can water them and help them come into our conscious mind. These seeds of happiness, love, loyalty, and reconciliation need watering every day. If we water them, we will feel joyful, and this will encourage them to stay longer. Keeping wholesome mental formations in our mind consciousness is the fourth practice of right diligence. The fourfold right diligence is nourished by joy and interest. If your practice does not bring you joy, you are not practicing correctly. The Buddha asked the monk Sona, "Is it true that before you became a monk, you were a musician?" Sona replied that it was so. The Buddha asked, "What happens if the string of your instrument is too loose?" "When you pluck it, there will be no sound," Sona replied. "What happens when the string is too taut?" "It will break." "The practice of the way is the same," the Buddha said. "Maintain your health. Be joyful. Do not force yourself to do things you cannot do. We need to know our physical and psychological limits. We shouldn't force ourselves to do ascetic practices or lose ourselves in sensual pleasures. Right diligence lies in the middle way, between the extremes of austerity and sensual indulgence. The teachings of the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness, investigating phenomena, diligence, joy, ease, concentration, and letting go, are also part of the practice of right diligence. Joy is a factor of awakening, and it is at the heart of right diligence. Ease, another factor of awakening, is also essential for right diligence. In fact, not only right diligence, but also right mindfulness and right concentration need joy and ease. Right diligence does not mean to force ourselves. If we have joy, ease, and interest, our effort will come naturally. When we hear the bell inviting us for walking or sitting meditation, we will have the energy to participate if we find meditation joyful and interesting. If we do not have the energy to practice sitting or walking meditation, it is because these practices do not bring us joy or transform us, or we do not yet see their benefit. When I wanted to become a novice monk, my family thought that a monk's life would be too difficult for me. But I knew it was the only way I could be happy, and I persisted. Once I became a novice, I felt as happy and free as a bird in the sky. When it came time for chanting sutras, I felt as though I had been invited to a concert. Sometimes, on moonlit nights, when the monks were chanting the sutras standing by the crescent pond, I thought I was in paradise listening to angels. When I could not attend morning chanting because I had another task, just hearing the words of the Sharangama Sutra coming from the Buddha Hall brought me happiness. Everyone at Tu Hu Pagoda practiced with interest, joy, and diligence. There was no forced effort, just the love and support of our teacher and brothers in the practice. At Plum Village, children participate in sitting and walking meditation and silent meals. At first, they do it just to be with their friends who are already practicing. But after they taste the peace and joy of meditation, they continue on their own because they want to. Sometimes it takes adults 4 or 5 years of practicing the outer form before they taste the true joy of practice. Master Guishan said, "Time flies like an arrow. If we do not live deeply, we waste our life." Guishan, 771 to 853, was one of the great Tang Dynasty meditation masters. Someone who can devote her life to the practice, who has a chance to be near her teacher and friends in the practice, has a wonderful opportunity that can bring her great happiness. If we lack right diligence, it is because we have not found a way to practice that is true for us, or have not felt deeply the need to practice. A mindful life can be wonderful. Waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are before me. I vow to live fully in each moment, and to look at all beings with eyes of compassion. Reciting this gatha can give us energy to live the day well. 24 hours are a treasure chest of jewels. If we waste these hours, we waste our life. The practice is to smile as soon as we wake up, recognizing this day as an opportunity for practicing. It is up to us not to waste it. When we look at all beings with eyes of love and compassion, we feel wonderful. With the energy of mindfulness, washing the dishes, sweeping the floor, or practicing sitting or walking meditation are all the more precious. Suffering can propel us to practice. When we are anxious or sad and see that these practices bring us relief, we will want to continue. It takes energy to look into suffering and to see what has brought about that suffering. But this insight will lead us to see how to end our suffering and the path needed to do so. When we embrace our suffering, we see its origins, and we see that it can end because there is a path. Our suffering is at the center. When we look into the compost, we see the flowers. When we look into the sea of fire, we see a lotus. The path that does not run away from but embraces our suffering is the path that will lead us to liberation. It is not always necessary for us to deal directly with our suffering. Sometimes we can just allow it to lie dormant in our store consciousness, and we use the opportunity to touch the refreshing and healing elements within us and around us with our mindfulness. They will take care of our pain, like antibodies taking care of the foreign bodies that have entered our bloodstream. When unwholesome seeds have arisen, we have to take care of them. When unwholesome seeds are dormant, our job is to help them sleep peacefully and be transformed at the base. With right view, we see the way we need to go, and our seeing gives us faith and energy. If we feel better after practicing walking meditation for an hour, we will have the determination to continue the practice. When we see how walking meditation brings peace to others, we will have even more faith in practice. With patience, we can discover the joys of life that are all around us, and we will have more energy, interest, and diligence. The practice of mindful living should be joyful and pleasant. If you breathe in and out and feel joy and peace, that is right diligence. If you suppress yourself, if you suffer during your practice, it probably is not right diligence. Examine your practice. See what brings you joy and happiness of a sustained kind. Try to spend time with a Sangha, brothers and sisters, who are creating a field of mindful energy that can make your practice easy. Work together with a teacher and with a friend to transform your suffering into compassion, peace, and understanding, and do it with joy and ease. That is right diligence. Chapter 15. Right Concentration. The practice of right concentration, Samyak Samadhi, is to cultivate a mind that is one-pointed. The Chinese character for concentration means, literally, maintaining evenness, neither too high nor too low, neither too excited nor too dull. Another Chinese term sometimes used for concentration means the abode of true mind. There are two kinds of concentration, active and selective. In active concentration, the mind dwells on whatever is happening in the present moment, even as it changes. This poem by a Buddhist monk, Vietnamese Diada master Huang Hai, ocean of fragrance, describes active concentration. The wind whistles in the bamboo, and the bamboo dances. When the wind stops, the bamboo grows still. The wind comes, and the bamboo welcomes it. The wind goes, and the bamboo lets it go. The poem continues, "A silver bird flies over the autumn lake. When it has passed, the lake's surface does not try to hold on to the image of the bird. As the bird flies over the lake, its reflection is lucid. After it is gone, the lake reflects the clouds and the sky just as clearly. When we practice active concentration, we welcome whatever comes along. We don't think about or long for anything else. We just dwell in the present moment with all our being. Whatever comes, comes. When the object of our concentration has passed, our mind remains clear, like a calm lake. When we practice selective concentration, we choose one object and hold on to it. During sitting and walking meditation, whether alone or with others, we practice. We know that the sky and the birds are there, but our attention is focused on our object. If the object of our concentration is a math problem, we don't watch TV or talk on the phone. We abandon everything else and focus on the object. When we are driving, the lives of the passengers in our car depend on our concentration. We don't use concentration to run away from our suffering. We concentrate to make ourselves deeply present. When we walk, stand, or sit in concentration, people can see our stability and stillness. Living each moment deeply, sustained concentration comes naturally, and that, in turn, gives rise to insight. Right concentration leads to happiness, and it also leads to right action. The higher our degree of concentration, the greater the quality of our life. Vietnamese girls are often told by their mothers that if they concentrate, they will be more beautiful. This is the kind of beauty that comes from dwelling deeply in the present moment. When a young lady moves inattentively, she does not look as fresh or at ease. Her mother may not use these words, but she is encouraging her daughter to practice right concentration. It is a pity she does not encourage her son to do the same. Everyone needs concentration. There are 9 levels of meditative concentration. The first 4 are the 4 dhyanas. These are concentrations on the form realm. The next 5 levels belong to the formless realm. When practicing the first dhyana, you still think. At the other 8 levels, thinking gives way to other energies. Formless concentrations are also practiced in other traditions, but when they are practiced outside of Buddhism, it is generally to escape from suffering, rather than to realize the liberation that comes with insight into our suffering. When you use concentration to run away from yourself or your situation, it is wrong concentration. Sometimes we need to escape our problems for relief, but at some time we have to return to face them. Worldly concentration seeks to escape. Supramundane concentration aims at complete liberation. To practice samadhi is to live deeply each moment that is given us to live. Samadhi means concentration. In order to be concentrated, we should be mindful, fully present, and aware of what is going on. Mindfulness brings about concentration. When you are deeply concentrated, you are absorbed in the moment. You become the moment. That is why samadhi is sometimes translated as absorption. Right mindfulness and right concentration lift us above the realms of sensual pleasures and craving, and we find ourselves lighter and happier. Our world is no longer gross and heavy, the realm of desires, karma dhatu. It is the realm of fine materiality, the realm of form, rupa dhatu. In the form realm, there are 4 levels of dhyana: mindfulness, concentration, joy, happiness, peace, and equanimity continue to grow through these 4 levels. After the 4th dhyana, the practitioner enters a deeper experience of concentration. the four formless dhyanas, where he or she can see deeply into reality. Here, sensual desire and materiality reveal their illusory nature and are no longer obstacles. You begin to see the impermanent, non-self, and interbeing nature of the phenomenal world. Earth, water, air, fire, space, time, nothingness, and perceptions inter are. Nothing can be by itself alone. The object of the fifth level of concentration is limitless space. When we begin to practice this concentration, everything seems to be space. But as we practice more deeply, we see that space is composed of and exists only in non-space elements, like earth, water, air, fire, and consciousness. Because space is only one of the six elements that make up all material things, we know space does not have a separate, independent existence. According to the teachings of the Buddha, nothing has a separate self. So space and everything else inter are. Space inter is with the other five elements. The object of the sixth level of concentration is limitless consciousness. At first, we see only consciousness, but then we see that consciousness is also earth, water, air, fire, and space. What is true of space is also true of consciousness. The object of the seventh level of concentration is nothingness. With normal perception, we see flowers, fruit, teapots, and tables, and we think they exist separately of one another. But when we look more deeply, we see that the fruit is in the flower, and that the flower, the cloud, and the earth are in the fruit. We go beyond outward appearances or signs and come to signlessness. At first, we think that the members of our family are separate from one another, but afterwards, we see that they contain each other. You are the way you are because I am the way I am. We see the intimate connection between people, and we go beyond signs. We used to think that the universe contains millions of separate entities. Now we understand the non-existence of signs. The eighth level of concentration is that of neither perception nor non-perception. We recognize that everything is produced by our perceptions, which are, at least in part, erroneous. Therefore, we see that we cannot rely on our old way of perceiving, and we want to be in direct touch with reality. We cannot stop perceiving altogether, but at least now we know that perception is perception of a sign. Since we no longer believe in the reality of signs, our perception becomes wisdom. We go beyond signs, no perception, but we do not become perceptionless, no non-perception. The ninth level of concentration is called cessation. Cessation, here, means the cessation of ignorance in our feelings and perceptions, not the cessation of feelings and perceptions. From this concentration is born insight. The poet Wen Zhu said, "As soon as we see with our eyes and hear with our ears, we open ourselves to suffering." We long to be in a state of concentration where we cannot see or hear anything, in a world where there is no perception. We wish to become a pine tree with the wind singing in our branches, because we believe that a pine tree does not suffer. The search for a place of non-suffering is natural. In the world of non-perception, the seventh, manas, and the eighth, alaya, consciousnesses, continue to function as usual. And our ignorance and internal formations remain intact in our store consciousness, and they manifest in the seventh consciousness. The seventh consciousness is the energy of delusion that creates the belief in a self and distinguishes self from other. Since the non-perception concentration does not transform our habit energies, when people emerge from that concentration, their suffering is intact. But when the meditator reaches the ninth level of concentration, the stage of arhat, manas is transformed, and the internal formations in the store consciousness are purified. the greatest internal formation is ignorance of the reality of impermanence and non-self. This ignorance gives rise to greed, hatred, confusion, pride, doubt, and views. Together, these afflictions produce a war of consciousness called manas, which always discriminates self from other. When someone practices well, the ninth level of concentration shines light on the reality of things and transforms ignorance. The seeds that used to cause you to be caught in self and non-self are transformed. Alia is freed from the grip of manas, and manas no longer has the function of making a self. Manas becomes the wisdom of equality that can see the interbeing and interpenetrating nature of things. It can see that others' lives are as precious as our own, because there is no longer discrimination between self and other. When manas loses its grip on store consciousness becomes the wisdom of the great mirror that reflects everything in the universe. When the sixth consciousness, manovijnana, is transformed, it is called the wisdom of wonderful observation. Mind consciousness continues to observe phenomena after it has been transformed into wisdom, but it observes them in a different way, because mind consciousness is aware of the interbeing nature of all that it observes, seeing the one in the many, all the manifestations of birth and death, coming and going, and so on, without being caught in ignorance. The first five consciousnesses become the wisdom of wonderful realization. Our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body that previously caused us to suffer become miracles that bring us to the garden of suchness. Thus, the transformation of all levels of consciousness is realized as four wisdoms. Our wrong consciousness and wrong perceptions are transformed thanks to the practice. At the ninth level of concentration, all eight consciousnesses are functioning. Perception and feeling are still there, but they are different from before, because they are free from ignorance. The Buddha taught many concentration practices. To practice the concentration on impermanence, every time you look at your beloved, see him as impermanent, and do your best to make him happy today. If you think he is permanent, you may believe that he will never improve. The insight into impermanence keeps you from getting caught in the suffering of craving, attachment, and despair. See and listen to everything with this insight. To practice the concentration on non-self, touch the nature of interbeing in everything you contact. This will bring you a lot of peace and joy and prevent you from suffering. The practice of the concentration on nirvana helps you to touch the ultimate dimension of reality and establish yourself in the realms of no birth and no death. The concentrations on impermanence, non-self, and nirvana are enough for us to practice our whole lives. In fact, the three are one. If you touch the nature of impermanence deeply, you touch the nature of non-self, interbeing, and nirvana. One concentration contains all concentrations. You don't need to do everything. In Mahayana Buddhism, there are hundreds of other concentrations, such as the Sharangama Samadhi, the concentration of the heroic march, the Siddharma Pundarika Samadhi, and the Avatamsaka Samadhi. Each is wonderful and important. According to the Lotus Sutra, we have to live in the historical and ultimate dimensions of reality at the same time. We have to live deeply our life as a wave so we can touch the substance of water in us. We walk, look, breathe, and eat in a way that we touch the absolute dimension of reality. We transcend birth and death and the fears of being and non-being, one and many. The Buddha is not found only on Gridhārakūta, the Vulture Peak. If you were to hear on the radio that the Buddha is going to reappear on Gridhārakūta Mountain and the public is invited to join him for walking meditation, all the seats on all the airplanes to India would be booked, and you might feel frustrated because you want to go also. Even if you were lucky enough to get a seat on that plane, it still might not be possible for you to enjoy practicing walking meditation with the Buddha. There would be so many people, most of whom don't know how to practice breathing in and out and dwelling in the present moment while walking. What is the use of going there? Look deeply at your intention. Do you want to fly halfway around the world so that later you can say you were with the Buddha? Many people want to do just that. They arrive at a place of pilgrimage, unable to be in the here and the now. After a few minutes of seeing the place, they rush to the next place. They take pictures to prove they were there, and they are eager to return home to show their friends. I was there. I have proof. That is me standing beside the Buddha. That would be the desire of many of the people who would go there. They are not able to walk with the Buddha. They are not able to be in the here and the now. They only want to say, I was there, and this is me standing beside the Buddha. But it is not true. They were not there, and that is not the Buddha. Being there is a concept, and the Buddha that you see is a mere appearance. You cannot photograph the real Buddha, even if you have a very expensive camera. If you don't have the opportunity to fly to India, please practice walking at home, and you can really hold the hand of the Buddha while you walk. Just walk in peace and happiness, and the Buddha is there with you. The one who flies to India and returns with his photo taken with the Buddha has not seen the real Buddha. You have the reality. He has only a sign. Don't run around looking for photo opportunities. Touch the real Buddha. He is available. Take his hand and practice walking meditation. When you can touch the ultimate dimension, you walk with the Buddha. The wave does not need to die to become water. She is already water. This is the concentration of the Lotus Sutra. Live every moment of your life deeply. And while walking, eating, drinking, and looking at the morning star, you touch the ultimate dimension. Chapter 16. Right Livelihood. To practice right livelihood, samyag ajiva, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and others. The sutras usually define right livelihood as earning a living without needing to transgress any of the 5 mindfulness trainings: not dealing in arms, in the slave trade, the meat trade, the sale of alcohol, drugs, or poisons, or making prophecies or telling fortunes. Monks and nuns must be careful not to make unreasonable demands on the laity for the 4 requisites of medicine, food, clothes, and lodging, and not to live with material requisites in excess of immediate needs. Bringing awareness to every moment, we try to have a vocation that is beneficial to humans, animals, plants, and the earth, or at least minimally harmful. We live in a society in which jobs are sometimes hard to find, but if it happens that our work involves harming life, we should try to find another job. Our vocation can nourish our understanding and compassion, or erode them. We should be awake to the consequences, far and near, of the way we earn our living. So many modern industries are harmful to humans and nature, even food production. Chemical pesticides and fertilizers can cause a lot of harm to the environment. Practicing right livelihood is difficult for farmers. If they do not use chemicals, it may be difficult for them to compete commercially. This is just one example. When you practice your profession or trade, observe the 5 mindfulness trainings. A job that involves killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, or selling drugs or alcohol is not right livelihood. If your company pollutes the rivers or the air, working there is not right livelihood. Making weapons or profiting from others' superstitions is also not right livelihood. People have superstitions, such as believing that their fate is sealed in the stars or in the palms of their hands. No one can be sure what will occur in the future. By practicing mindfulness, we can change the destiny astrologers have predicted for us. Moreover, prophecies can be self-fulfilling. Composing or performing works of art can also be livelihood. A composer, writer, painter, or performer has an effect on the collective consciousness. Any work of art is, to a large extent, a product of the collective consciousness. Therefore, the individual artist needs to practice mindfulness so that his or her work of art helps those who touch it practice right attention. A young man wanted to learn how to draw lotus flowers, so he went to a master to apprentice with him. The master took him to a lotus pond and invited him to sit there. The young man saw flowers bloom when the sun was high, and he watched them return into buds when night fell. The next morning, he did the same. When one lotus flower wilted and its petals fell into the water, he just looked at the stalk, the stamen, and the rest of the flower, and then moved on to another lotus. He did that for 10 days. On the 11th day, the master asked him, "Are you ready?" And he replied, "I will try." The master gave him a brush, and although the young man's style was childlike, the lotus he drew was beautiful. He had become the lotus, and the painting came forth from him. You could see his naivete concerning technique, but deep beauty was there. Right livelihood is not just a personal matter. It is our collective karma. Suppose I am a school teacher, and I believe that nurturing love and understanding in children is a beautiful occupation. I would object if someone were to ask me to stop teaching and become, for example, a butcher. But when I meditate on the interrelatedness of things, I see that the butcher is not the only person responsible for killing animals. We may think the butcher's livelihood is wrong and ours is right, but if we didn't eat meat, he would not have to kill. Right livelihood is a collective matter. The livelihood of each person affects everyone else. The butcher's children might benefit from my teaching, while my children, because they eat meat, share some responsibility for the butcher's livelihood. Suppose a farmer who sells his cattle as meat wants to receive the 5 mindfulness trainings. He wants to know if he can, in light of the first training to protect life. He feels that he gives his cattle the best conditions for their well-being. He even operates his own slaughterhouse so that there is no unnecessary cruelty inflicted on the animals when he puts an end to their lives. He inherited his farm from his father, and he has a family to support. This is a dilemma. What should he do? His intentions are good, but he has inherited his farm and his habit energies from his ancestors. Every time a cow is slaughtered, it leaves an impression on his consciousness, which will come back to him in dreams, during meditation, or at the moment of death. It is right livelihood to look after his cows so well while they are alive. He has the wish to be kind to his cows, and he also wants the security of regular income for himself and his family. He should continue to look deeply and practice mindfulness with his local sangha. As his insight deepens, the way out of the situation where he finds himself killing to make a living will present itself. Everything we do contributes to our effort to practice right livelihood. It is more than just the way we earn our paycheck. We cannot succeed at having a right livelihood 100%, but we can resolve to go in the direction of compassion and reducing suffering. And we can resolve to help create a society in which there is more right livelihood and less wrong livelihood. Millions of people, for example, make their living in the arms industry, helping directly or indirectly to manufacture conventional and nuclear weapons. The U.S., Russia, France, Britain, China, and Germany are the primary suppliers of these weapons. Weapons are then sold to third world countries, where the people do not need guns, they need food. To manufacture or sell weapons is not right livelihood. but the responsibility for this situation lies with all of us. Politicians, economists, and consumers. We have not yet organized a compelling national debate on this problem. We have to discuss this further, and we have to keep creating new jobs so that no one has to live on the profits from weapons manufacture. If you are able to work in a profession that helps realize your ideal of compassion, be grateful. And please try to help create proper jobs for others by living mindfully, simply, and sanely. Use all of your energy to try to improve the situation. To practice right livelihood means to practice right mindfulness. Every time the telephone rings, hear it as a bell of mindfulness. Stop what you are doing, breathe in and out consciously, and then proceed to the telephone. The way you answer the phone will embody right livelihood. We need to discuss among ourselves how to practice mindfulness in the workplace, how to practice right livelihood. Do we breathe when we hear the telephone ringing and before we pick up the phone to make a call? Do we smile while we take care of others? Do we walk mindfully from meeting to meeting? Do we practice right speech? Do we practice deep and total relaxation after hours of hard work? Do we live in ways that encourage everyone to be peaceful and happy and to have a job that is in the direction of peace and happiness? These are very practical and important questions. To work in a way that encourages this kind of thinking and acting, in a way that encourages our ideal of compassion, is to practice right livelihood. If someone has a profession that causes living beings to suffer and oppresses others, it will infect their own consciousness, just as when we pollute the air that we ourselves have to breathe. Many people get rich by means of wrong livelihood. Then they go to their temple or church and make donations. These donations come from feelings of fear and guilt, rather than the wish to bring happiness to others and relieve others of suffering. When a temple or church receives large donations, those responsible for receiving the funds must understand this. They should do their best to help the donor transform by showing him or her a way out of that wrong livelihood. Such persons need, more than anything, the teachings of the Buddha. As we study and practice the Noble Eightfold Path, we see that each element of the path is contained within all the other seven elements. We also see that each element of the path contains the noble truths of suffering, the making of suffering, and the ending of suffering. Practicing the first noble truth, we recognize our suffering and call it by its name: depression, anxiety, fear, or insecurity. Then we look directly into that suffering to discover its basis, and that is practicing the second noble truth. These two practices contain the first two elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, namely right view and right thinking. All of us have a tendency to run away from suffering, but now, with the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, we have the courage to face our suffering directly. We use right mindfulness and right concentration to look courageously at our suffering. The looking deeply that shows us clearly the basis of our suffering is right view. Right view will not show one reason for our suffering, but layers upon layers of causes and conditions, seeds we have inherited from our parents, grandparents, and ancestors, seeds in us that have been watered by our friends and the economic and political situations of our country, and so many other causes and conditions. Now the time has come to do something to lessen our suffering. Once we know what is feeding our suffering, we find a way to cease ingesting that nutriment, whether it is edible food, the food of sense impression, the food we receive from our intentions, or the food from our consciousness. We do this by practicing right speech, right action, and right livelihood, remembering that right speech is also listening deeply. To practice these three aspects, we take the mindfulness trainings as our guide. Practicing according to the mindfulness trainings We see that when we speak, act, or earn our living, we do it with right mindfulness.